Check. 1, 2.
Program in the lower right-hand corner. Few of us ever get all the way over there, but it is there, and I will mention particularly the fact that those who donate $60 or more will receive a free copy of the book, The Vancouver Institute, An Experiment in Public Education, which includes a history of the Institute and an assortment of some of the very interesting lectures given over the last few years. I should also remind you that both donations and memberships are tax deductible. This evening, we have the very great pleasure of hearing from Professor Walter Cohn. He was born in Vienna in 1923. Most of his career has been in the United States, but he has a very real connection with Canada. He came here during World War II, and during that trying period had the distinction, if one can call it that, of being both an enemy alien and a member of the Canadian Armed Forces. He obtained his bachelor's degree at the University of Toronto in 1945 and his master's in 1946. Those, I believe, were in the field of mathematics. His doctorate degree he obtained at Harvard in 1948. In the field of physics, and he is a physicist who has also achieved great distinction in the field of chemistry. I will not attempt to outline the whole of his career, but just a year and a little more ago, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for his development of what's called the density functional theory. And was recognized as somebody who has made enormous contributions to the understanding of the electronic structure of materials. He has, for a good many years now, lived in California, first at the University of California in San Diego, and then the University of California in Santa Barbara, where he is still active and still a member of the university faculty. I had thought that I would spend a few minutes explaining to you some of the aspects of quantum theory and so on that you will be hearing about. And then I reflected back to my last connection with physics and chemistry, which was in 1950, my first year at this university, when I thought I might have some talent as a scientist. And having got 50% in the physics course and 43% in chemistry, I realized I'd better try it for something else. So I'm sure that I can't assist you, but I'm sure I will find it interesting, as I am sure you will, Professor Cohn.
Can you hear me? Any problems back there? Raise your hands if there are problems. I want to begin by saying that I'm really very happy to be back again in Canada. It's been a little while. I did well this time. On previous visits, I typically would forget my passport simply because just couldn't get around to thinking of Canada as a foreign country. this time I brought my passport. My very good old friend Eric Vogt called me some months ago and said, Walter, you have never wishes me a favor. So it's a long ways off, but I'd like you to come here to Vancouver and give one of these lectures. So if any of you know how to get around such an invitation, let me know. I didn't. So I'm glad to be here. I have already a wonderful day. All kinds of experiences, including your great anthropological museum, which I have not seen before. I would like to say a little bit more about my Canadian past. You heard that I was came here, born in Austria, converted by Hitler into a German, converted by Hitler into a refugee, came here with the in the category of an enemy alien. And you heard that I also served in the Canadian Infantry Corps. What you didn't hear is that I did both of those things simultaneously. The mounted police for a while insisted that even though I was in the army, which they were not particularly interested in, I should still report to them as an enemy alien on a monthly basis. However, I had a sympathetic platoon commander, and we got around that. Seriously, I do want to use this opportunity to express my enormous appreciation for the wonderful scientific start I got as a student at the University of Toronto. I came out of the internment, a Canadian. My parents did not manage to get out of Austria, so I was by myself. A Canadian family took me into their home, gave me an opportunity to study at the University of Toronto, and I was very fortunate that there was a program of instruction available at the time. I think at this time it's called, that particular program is called Mathematics, Physics, and Chemistry. At that time it was called Mathematics and Physics, but it actually prepared students also for chemistry, which was, in my opinion, the best available in North America. Quote-unquote proof of that opinion, I want to mention that there was then, and I think still is, an annual competition between teams of university students in mathematics from all over North America, so-called Putnam. Is that still running?
Yes. Yes.
During the years that I was a student, Toronto entered that competition every other year. I'll explain why that was. And every time they entered it, they won it. And this was for about a decade. They entered it only every other year because the rules of the game were that the winning team set the exam for the next year. And I want to also say, in case you get the idea that I might have participated in one of those, I did not. I was a senior in the off year, so I. So this does not reflect on me at all, but it does reflect on the quality of the instruction. I had, in addition to the instruction, which sort of sounds very impersonal, I had absolutely wonderful people that taught me and that also kind of helped me in personal ways. One person is a gentleman by the name of Sam Beatty, and some of the people in the audience know about him. A great person from a little town in Ontario. He was, at the time I was in Toronto, he was chairman of the math, head of the math department, and also dean of the Faculty of Arts. And later, after I'd left here, he became president of the, president's the right title, was it chancellor? Of the University of Toronto. And in fact, he and I, he was, let's say, roughly two or three times my age. We actually became very good personal friends. He was a tremendous help to me and other people. We arrived here in the middle of the year. It was during the war. Things were all shaken up. And it's just an incredibly humane and helpful person. Never forgotten him. I've even written a little piece about him and published it. Other outstanding people, so Beattie was in mathematics, McLennan was a world renowned person who had actually died some years earlier in physics, but he had left behind a great tradition in low temperature physics of which I again was the beneficiary. Another person I want to mention was John Lytton Syng, S-Y-N-G-E, a relative of the Irish poet John Millington Syng, and another great person. One of the great things about him was he inherited from his literary family just a wonderful way of speaking. So I first started going to his courses just to hear him talk without being able to understand anything yet. But I picked something up anyway. Later, I visited him. He returned eventually to Ireland, and I spent something like 3 weeks there as his guest. And I got to know his daughter very well, Kathleen, who became a prominent mathematician. And I heard from her that he just died very recently in his late 90s. Another colorful figure of the time was Leopold Infeld. I think he became something of a nationally known person, originally Polish, and came here from a three-year stint working with Einstein, doing some very important series of very important papers, and a brilliant lecturer, who then somehow got caught in some political business. He was a passive bystander, really, eventually was found himself in a position where he had to leave the university and the country. And it was, I think, a very great loss for everybody. I'd perhaps also mention that among my approximate contemporaries at the time, there were at least two people who made a very considerable name for themselves. One was Kaplansky, who later became, in fact, fairly recently, perhaps 15 years ago, became the director of the National Institute of Mathematics in Berkeley. And another person who has remained in Canada, with whom I had some contact just a couple of years ago, was Coleman. But there were many other people who had the ability, as I guess I did, to take advantage of the fantastic educational program that is offered here. So I certainly am permanently extremely grateful. I'm grateful also for something that happened after I got my master's degree here, namely I was expelled from Canada. My teachers who liked my work, they said, we won't admit you here for a PhD program. You need to get some additional experience somewhere else. Go away. And so I went away. And eventually, I got my doctorate in the United States. Towards the end of that work, I was looking for jobs in Canada. Well, it was I got my PhD in 1948, to be quite precise, and there were no jobs in Canada. There just were no jobs. I wrote to every institution that I knew of, and there was nothing. I remember specifically writing to Professor Schramm here, and I remember his particular response, but I won't tell you what it was. But you have observed that I'm not a professor here. let me now begin my talk, which starts with a phrase that I like, whose cadence I like very, very much, through a glass darkly. Lest I be accused of plagiarism, I want to say I did not make up that phrase. I heard it first in an Ingmar Bergman film, and I gather that Bergman got it from the New Testament, and somebody told me this in Corinthians 2. The word dark occurs there, and I think we can agree that historically, if we look back at any period in history, the future as seen from that period has always been shrouded in a considerable degree of darkness. Sort of an extreme reaction to this, perhaps it's known even in Canada, was that due to Henry Ford, who summarized the situation in the pithy phrase, "History is bunk." I do not subscribe to that, feel that I do want to talk about the future, but after all, what other basis do we have talking about the future except looking at the past? Here, just to protect myself a little bit, I want to quote Niels Bohr. Niels Bohr, certainly one of the very greatest physicists in the century, by many considered to be the greatest physicist of the century. I'll come back to him later. I worked at his institute as a postdoctoral fellow in the early 50s, and at that time, he was quoted as having said, prediction is immensely difficult, especially when it concerns the future. Since this comes from a great man, I want you to accept that and to keep it in mind and be charitable towards what you will hear from me. Now, this is the turn of the century, turn of the millennium, and we all know that has no intrinsic significance, even arguments as to whether it happened or will happen a year from now. Nevertheless, and I agree with that, of course, it has no intrinsic significance, but it's nevertheless a useful marker that gives one an occasion to take stock of the past and contemplate and perhaps commit oneself to the future. Since somewhere in the Middle Ages, Jews have been doing this everywhere, annually, on their most important holiday, Yom Kippur. This is done annually by Jews, and I think everybody has picked up the fact that the Pope has declared this year as a Jubilee year, and just a few days ago, as perhaps most of you have read in the newspapers, he offered a rather unprecedented, in fact, an unprecedented apology on behalf of Roman Catholics and the Church for sins committed over the last 2,000 years. I'd like to mention to you that the Vatican is in the process of organizing a series of scientific meetings on the occasion of this Jubilee year, and that I received a very friendly invitation to participate in one of these meetings, and I look forward to doing that. most of my talk will be spent on reflection concerning the past century. Then I'll turn to the future, not so much to really prognosticate, but at least pose some questions. I want to say that it's important to remember that even posing the questions is subject to Niels Bohr's remark about the future, because what appear like very important problems and questions today may very well be totally forgotten as problems or relevant questions in the future. now, Charles Dickens begins one of his novels, and I've forgotten which one it was. I think it was The Tale of Two Cities, but I could be wrong, with a phrase which is approximately, "It was the best of times and it was the worst of times." Can somebody confirm, was it The Tale of Two Cities? It was, thank you. now, that characterization seems to me most appropriate for the last century. For science, the century was truly a golden age. In my opinion, that century is unmatched in that respect, with respect to science, in all of human history. And as one person whose working period fell into that century, I consider myself extremely fortunate. In the area of human affairs, the century's record has been very mixed. Yes, there were some very important positive human developments. There was I mention them in no particular order, the end of colonialism, the adoption of universal human rights, not always observed, great advances in the area of civil rights, substantial improvement in the status of women, a growing sense of global community, including a global language, English. But I personally find these positives far outweighed by the massive brutality of man against man in the two world wars, in the Shoah, and in other crimes against humanity, some of them very recently. I'd like to talk now a little bit in an introductory way about science, because I consider this last century as having been characterized by in a decisive way by the developments of science and the technologies that grew out of these scientific developments. Let me go I did in fact look at a little booklet that lists the Nobel Prizes to date. The Nobel Prize started exactly at the beginning of the century. And so looking through this is one way of being reminded of what happened in science. The first Nobel Prize in science went to Röntgen, the discoverer of X-rays, in the year 1901. The discovery of X-rays exemplifies three phases of science: the search for truth, service to mankind in general, and service to national governments. The discovery of X-rays coming to the search for truth, I mentioned that the discovery of X-rays very quickly led to the unequivocal proof of the existence of crystal lattices and their quantitative characterization. And out of that grew a whole field, important field of science, the physics of solids. Your transistors, everything that you come across in daily life, all the high-tech developments of recent decades, all stem or can be traced back or depend on this discovery by Röntgen of X-rays. Certainly an enormously important contribution to pure science, to a fuller understanding of truth, of the truth of the material world around us. Secondly, almost immediately, X-rays became very important in the field of medicine. We know this, we've all experienced this, experienced the diagnostic use of X-rays in every dentist chair, for example, and also, of course, the therapeutic use of X-rays for the cancer therapy. Immensely important in for the benefit of mankind in general. Finally, in recent decades, people who are, I think, often called so-called star warriors, the most famous of them being the physicist Edward Teller, have become intoxicated with the possibility, which is not yet realized, of an X-ray laser. It's certainly something that might well be realized in the future. The X-ray laser, if it is, becomes a reality, would be kind of the ultimate death ray in the ultimate nuclear showdown in outer space. Professor Teller, a brilliant physicist, was had extremely strong feelings about our Cold War confrontation with the Soviet Union and was one of the great propagators or proponents of the program to develop military X-ray lasers. So that's an example of the application of science for national purposes, not general humanitarian purposes. This was directed against the Soviet Union on behalf of the United States. When I looked at this list of Nobel laureates, although I've, of course, known about many of the contributions of these people, nevertheless, looking at this was really quite a breathtaking experience. And I will now try to characterize a little bit my view of what were the kind of stellar advances, scientific advances. So I start with a remarkable group of people who developed the so-called quantum mechanics that our chair declined to explain to you. I will also not explain it to you, but I'll just say that it was an enormous revolution, not just a scientific revolution, an intellectual revolution. It replaced previous notions of cause and effect as being something, a very definitive relationship, by introducing elements of probability into the fundamental nature of the world, introducing these probabilistic aspects of the world at the same time in a strictly quantitative, precise quantitative manner. And it has changed it has changed thinking, not only in physics and chemistry, but in all other sciences and also in the humanities. There's a list of brilliant people that together built this new framework, and I pick what I think are the most important ones: Max Planck, Niels Bohr, Albert Einstein, Werner Heisenberg, Erwin Schrödinger, and Paul Dirac. Those Nobel Prizes were given over a period of some roughly 20 years, roughly the first 20, 25 years of the century. Now, you noticed perhaps, you picked perhaps up the name of Albert Einstein in this list, and you said perhaps to yourselves, well, Albert Einstein, I know him as the creator of relativity theory. Of course, you're right, but Albert Einstein never received his Nobel Prize for his work in relativity theory. He received it for his work on quantum mechanics. Albert Einstein did, in fact, create the so-called special and general theory of relativity, which has revolutionized our understanding of space, of time, and of gravitation, showing them to be profoundly interrelated. Time magazine, which perhaps some of you still read, I don't, had him as the man of the century. And in choosing him as the man of the century, Eric and I looked at that issue of time this afternoon, mentioned both the fact that he was a perhaps a better known person than anybody else representing the impact of science on the past century, and that at the same time he was known and highly appreciated for his great humanity. Another person on the list of Nobel laureates, whom I will say a few words about, remember there are altogether about 500 in science, so I'm not giving you a complete list, is Fritz Haber, H-A-B-E-R, Haber, or if you pronounce it in English, it would be Haber, who, a German physical chemist, who managed to fix nitrogen, which is of course very abundant in the atmosphere, fix it and make it available for as a chemical material, thereby allowing the production of fertilizers, artificial fertilizers. A brilliant accomplishment, scientific accomplishment, and at the same time of enormous benefit to mankind. It'd be absolutely inconceivable to support today's population without artificial fertilizers. The same Haber, I'll give you another example of the same kind later, scientists have, like the rest of us, I guess, have often quite different sides to their personality. The same Haber, who provided this enormous boon to mankind, was also introduced poison gas in World War I on behalf of his emperor, William II. Another two people that I want to mention, Hermann Staudinger and Paul Florey. who for the first time discovered the structure of what are now called polymers. They, as today they are known in the popular parlance as plastics or as artificial fibers, and I don't need to tell anybody how those materials have impacted chemistry and have impacted our everyday lives. Next, I mentioned three people, Bardeen, Bratton, and Shockley, who in 1948 invented the transistor. And our high-tech technology of today is rooted in that discovery. I mention as an aside that a few years after their development of the transistor, I had the opportunity to work for a few months for Bill Shockley as his assistant. And as a second aside, again exemplifying the complexity of scientists, I also mentioned that towards the end of his life, Shockley became a promoter of what he considered to be scientific racism. Next, I mention Watson, Crick, and Wilkins, who extracted the understanding of the structure of the DNA molecule from the X-ray data, I've mentioned X-rays before, taken by Rosalind Franklin, a lady who worked in England in the laboratory of Professor Wilkins. Rosalind Franklin did not share in the Nobel Prize. She had died before it was given, but the person in whose laboratory she worked did share in the prize. It's a case that is discussed by historians of science as to whether it shows some discrimination against women. This discovery of the structure of DNA in the middle of the century has totally transformed and dominated molecular biology ever since. It is at the root of gene manipulation, cloning, and the so-called Human Genome Project, a multi-decade project that's expected to be finished within the next 10 years, that will totally map out the sequence of the human DNA molecule. And there you will, in a single long fiber, have all there is to a human being. Or is it all there is? Next, I mention the two scientists, one German, one Swiss, Binnick and Rohrer, who developed the tunneling electron microscope, a new form of microscope, not the optical microscope, not the more conventional so-called electron microscope. This is a tunneling electron microscope, and it magnifies atoms on surfaces by a factor of about 10 million. Some of you still played with microscopes as children, then you'll know that you might get a magnification of 100 or 1,000, perhaps. This is 10 million, so an individual atom on a picture taken through such a microscope will be about typically half an inch in diameter. this sort of has provided the kind of, since you can see the representations of these pictures visually, it has returned science to an age where one made observations by eye. That tradition was somewhat submerged for many years. Next, I mention the virtually unassailable evidence for the creation of the universe in a Big Bang that took place some 20 or so billion years ago. The discoverers were Penzias and Wilson. This was happened in the 1960s, and I can still remember the unbelievable excitement, because at that time there were two contending views of the origin of the universe. One was the so-called Big Bang model, and the other one was called the continuous creation model. They were both consistent with observations, astronomical and other observations. And they were sort of riding side by side. And then came this one discovery. It was a discovery, again, a wonderful sort of mind-boggling discovery, that throughout the entire universe, there is present some radiation of the same kind as ordinary lights or radio waves, but of a very long wavelength, which is left over from the very beginning of the universe. And that radiation had been theoretically predicted and was through extremely careful observation discovered by accident by these two scientists. They found this radiation. They were not looking for it. They couldn't explain it away, and eventually came to the conclusion, aha, that must be radiation that had been predicted as the fossil remnant of the Big Bang. So that's my rundown of some great scientific contributions of the last century. So I think it's hard to argue that it's been a glorious century for science. The more human contributions of science based on these discoveries are manifold. Modern medicine has raised human life expectancy by different amounts in different parts of the world, but let's say something on the order of 50%, some cases more, some less. It has eradicated many diseases. It has cut infant mortality enormously. These are all very important positive achievements. But there's also been a menacing side effect of these medical advances, namely the increase of the world's population from 1.5 to 6 billion people in one century, unprecedented fourfold increase. And this population increase, coupled with greatly increased per capita consumption, especially in the developed countries, put enormous pressure on the ecosystem. Pollution of air and water, depletion of water resources, depletion of fossil fuels, depletion of topsoil, dramatic reduction of forest lands, and number of species, global warming. All those are problems that are simply multiplied, or it's perhaps not a good way of saying it. The magnitude of these problems is proportional to the number of people. And with the number of people having quadrupled in one century, many of these problems have for the first time become truly menacing. While this same science-based technology has to a large extent liberated man from the drudgery of earlier times, it has also put at man's disposal terrifying weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, chemical, and biological. When I look into the future through a glass darkly, as the Bible says, I see a number of obvious concrete challenges. Halting and partly reversing the population explosion. I put that very highly, and in fact it's an activity in which, not a, an activity in which I'm professionally involved, but which I'm strongly involved with as a citizen. The problem of the overconsumption of non-renewable resources, air and water pollution, these are all problems that need addressing and can be and should be addressed. Those are practical consequences of the scientific progress that has led to problems that we now have to deal with. Now, as for science of the future, I think I can make some fairly safe extrapolations, but they're not terribly interesting. I'll run through them. The computer revolution, for example, clearly has not yet run its course, and we may certainly expect increases in the power of computers, memory, and speed by factors of 100 or more along present lines of development. There is a new line of developments in the area of computers. They're called quantum computers, so they combine more conventional computing with a particularly characteristic aspect of the quantum theory. And while these quantum computers have been theoretically considered, and if they could be realized in practice, would no doubt take computing far beyond what I described now and really usher in a revolution that I think nobody can foresee at the moment, it is still very questionable whether they ever will be realizable. Nobody's betting on it. Another area where we can make predictions is the ability to theoretically design new materials for electronic, structural, and medical applications. This ability to do this with a computer rather than in a laboratory. Materials includes that my own work has contributed. Gene manipulation is still in its infancy, and we all know that, and it will go further. Where it will go, I do not dare to predict. The completion of the human genome project, which will tell us exactly what these genes are and where they are, is impossible to doubt that it will make an enormous impact. Now, this gene manipulation, of course, raises all kinds of rather deep human problems. They've not yet been seriously addressed. It will lead to really uncharted waters. Here, when man can basically begin to change himself, raises deep questions: what is the place of man in the universe? So far, it has still been possible to lead one's life without deeply addressing this question. I think as gene manipulation progresses, this will become impossible, and such deep questions will have to be faced more seriously. Going to another area, so-called string theory. That is, sounds like a rather playful term. However, its devotees claim, and to my embarrassment, call it the theory of everything. Not exactly a modest position, I might remark that from my viewpoint, it is so far not yet the theory of anything, because nobody has been able to confront it with observations or with experiments. But many of the best minds in science are enthusiastic about it, working about it, have been working on it for about 20 years, and it needs to be taken seriously. So these, I mention one more thing, neuroscience. Neuroscience, if you look at what has happened to it over the last century, you will find that as a field of applied chemistry and applied electrochemistry, it's made unbelievable advances, how these neurons interact with one another, how signals travel between them, all that is being understood enormously better than it was. Now, to my mind, it's the position of many of the workers in this area that that has already, to a large extent, quote-unquote, explained consciousness. Now, this is a tricky business, because what do you call explaining consciousness? And I don't think that there is an understanding of how to answer that question. It may be, as some people claim, that consciousness is just something totally out of these scientific considerations, and other people say not at all, it is simply a manifestation of these physical and chemical processes. That's a question that certainly has not yet been, where there is no agreement, and remains to be looked into in the future. Yes, so now I want to briefly talk about something that many of you will have heard about. In the last decade or two, some scholars from the humanities and social sciences have attempted to discredit the entire scientific enterprise. They argue that it is entirely subjective, and that so-called scientific progress is a social phenomenon, and not unlike, don't be shocked by the coming phrase, it's what's being used, not unlike the changes in the fashions of ladies' clothing. 10 years ago, there was a certain scientific view. Today, it's different, just like fashions change. I believe deeply that these considerations are misguided and result from a basic misunderstanding of the nature of the natural sciences, which are not arbitrary, but which are being guided and challenged by observations and experiments in the real world. I'm convinced that science will continue to provide mankind with ever greater opportunities for leading better and richer lives. But at the same time, it also provides the means for degrading the environment, provides the means for making powerful new weapons. In a very short time on the scale of human history, science has created an entirely new global reality, in which the lives of all humans are inextricably intertwined. We may not like it, we may like it, but it's a reality. Until quite recently, circling the globe took several months. Airplanes now do it in one day, and electronic messages do it in 1/7 of a second. This is it's a totally different world from the world of 100 years ago. So while this unbelievable change of the external environment has taken place, the fundamental nature of man has changed very little, I believe. How will we as humans deal with the heightened possibilities of science, heightened possibilities for better and for worse? To my mind, this is the big question mark on the other dark side of the glass. My own principal conclusion from the great catastrophes of the last century is that when the inevitable new threats will arise, it is less than ever permissible to look the other way. And here I'd like to quote for you a statement made around the middle of this century that many of you will have heard by Pastor Niemöller, a German Protestant minister, reflecting on the rise of Nazism in Germany. He said the following. He said, this is on the subject of necessity for not ignoring the new threats. He said, the Nazis first came for the communists, and I did not speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Catholics, and I didn't speak up because I was a Protestant. And then they came for me, and by that time, no one was left to speak up. As the world becomes ever smaller and ever more crowded, this kind of sturdy morality, which, by the way, is not unlike the morality that I was taught at home, becomes more and more relevant. Lastly, and Mr. Chairman, how much time do I have? I don't want to overtax the audience.
Whatever you like, but 10 minutes?
Yes, fine. I'd like to say a little bit on a subject that you obviously related to what I've already spoken about, namely the question of the social responsibility of scientists, social responsibility, if any, of scientists. I'll refer first to two of the great scientists of this age, and I want to just show you a rather nice picture. Let's see if we are in business here. No. Okay, there you see the lights are not out, but can it be seen adequately? Okay. Okay, thank you. So that's the picture of this rather dapper-looking gentleman on the left is Einstein, and next to him is Niels Bohr. I've talked about, of course, everybody knows about Einstein. Not so many people know about Bohr. They are seen discussing things in Copenhagen. This was a discussion that went on for several years and was watched by the entire world of science. Einstein had some very profound criticisms of the new quantum theory. And like every really important debate, it ended inconclusively. Now, both of these people expressed themselves on this question of responsibility of scientists to society. Niels Bohr felt that scientists had a particularly great responsibility. He was himself a very international scientist. His laboratory in Copenhagen was the center for scientific studies by scientists from literally all over the world. He insisted on having a meeting with Churchill to express his ideas of an open world. He was very hard to understand. He spoke both Danish and English, but you never know which it was. Furthermore, you very often didn't hear anything because he talked in such a low voice. Well, Churchill listened to him for a while, had him shown out with strong instructions never to let this man in again. He wrote and worked for months on a letter to the United Nations shortly after the end of the war, which didn't have, again, the impact that he had hoped it would have. However, in one respect, he had a lot to show. He was really one of the initial conceptualizers of what eventually became that great European laboratory, CERN, C-E-R-N, in Geneva. And that is has been a wonderful success. It's a European laboratory, but it's open to qualified scientists from around the world, and is really a wonderful example of what international cooperation can achieve. Albert Einstein, on the other hand, I have here a copy of an actual Xerox copy of a short correspondence that involves Einstein on this matter, social responsibility of scientists. There's a letter of inquiry sent to him, which is quite long. I'll just read sort of the very end of it, and then I'll read Einstein's pithy response. The inquiry ends in the following paragraphs. For instance, the question has been raised, to what extent was the discovery of the formula E equal mc squared, that everybody has seen written somewhere, energy is equal to mass times velocity of light squared. To what extent is this discovery a moral or a non-moral event? Was this discovery motivated one way or the other by your unusual degree of humanitarianism? This question seems to us relevant to the contention of many that pure science can have no motive other than the motive of curiosity. There are a few more words here, but I will now go to the response, which is six lines. The inquiry is probably 50. The response is, dear sir, my scientific work is motivated by an irresistible longing to understand the secrets of nature and by no other feelings. My love for justice and the striving to contribute towards the improvement of human conditions are quite independent of my scientific interests. Yours sincerely, Albert Einstein. So you have here this statement, couldn't be clearer, that the scientist has no particular social responsibility because he's a scientist. Now, actually, if you think about the life of Einstein, he didn't act accordingly. One of his best known interventions in public affairs was the letter that he wrote to President Roosevelt at the instigation of a colleague, Leo Szilard, in which he pointed out during the Second World War, pointed out to the president that the Germans had the scientific know-how to build an atomic bomb, that there were reasons, in his opinion, to fear that they were working on such a project, which indeed they were, and that it was urgent to avoid being blackmailed by the Germans in possession of an atomic bomb, and therefore the United States should start a crash program, became known as the Manhattan Project. So there, obviously, he spoke as a scientist, as somebody who could judge these matters of nuclear weapons, and felt that he needed to express himself as a scientist in the public domain. The question of social responsibility of scientists was also the subject of a Nobel laureate panel discussion last December, in which all the Nobel laureates, including myself, participated. I want to show you 3 or 4 minutes of, and that will conclude my lecture, excerpts of a videotape that the Nobel Foundation sent me. So you will see the wide variety of views of the 1999 Nobel laureates, including the great German writer Günter Grass, on this matter. Okay, can we... Yes, that it gets better. This is, I will try to write a little running commentary. This is, what you saw was a bust of Nobel. This is Günter Grass in the center, and this is at a reception during this is a Dutch physicist.
I Bernadottebiblioteket på Stockholms slott ska de möta unga forskare från hela
världen.
Forskare som ska utveckla det nya millenniets vetenskap. Nick Going från engelska
universitetet i debatten.
Welcome from me, Nick Going, to the splendor of the King's Bernadotte Library in the Royal Palace.
This is where the panel debate took place.
Before he became famous, and where scientists, philosophers, theologians, and writers all used to gather, both to work on and to gossip about the major issues of today. It's a spirit we continue now, to air the concerns and challenges of science in the next millennium. I'm joined by Günter Grass of Germany, winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature, who labels himself Spätaufklärer, the belated apostle of enlightenment in an era that has grown tired of reason. Also by Professor Günter Blobel, born in Silesia, Germany, now from New York, who won the Medicine Prize for his work on proteins. By Professor Ahmed Zuhail from Egypt, the chemistry laureate, rewarded for his work at the California Institute of Technology on spectroscopy. By Professor Gerard Etthoff from the Netherlands, the physics laureate, for his joint work with Professor Veltman on pure physics. Also by Professor Robert Mundell from Columbia University in New York City, awarded the Economics Prize for his work on monetary policies under different exchange rates. And by the way, he believes Britain and Sweden will join the euro. Finally, by Professor Walter Cohn,
he's your man,
from Vienna, now at the University of California in Santa Barbara. Professor Cohn was the 1998 chemistry laureate, and he joins us because of his strong concerns about the responsibility of science in the coming years, which he will shortly address in a lecture in Canada entitled For Better and For Worse.
That's this lecture, but I changed the title.
A number of young scientists, some 30 or so, from right around the globe, including Singapore, Russia, Japan, Europe, Australia, America, and Africa. They will join our discussion with their hopes and concerns. But first, a taste of the remarkable scientific discoveries being made as the millennium ends.
Okay, I will skip
here,
that.
Here, the massive genome project mapping our genes.
Pardon us for perhaps a minute of fast-forwarding.
the Spätaufklärer, the Enlightener, Günter Grass. You published in 1999 this wonderful book, My Century, a running revisionist commentary of the 20th century, with a chapter for each year. You began in 1900 with the Kaiser. You end in 99 with the words, I'm also looking forward to the year 2000. We'll see what comes of it. So imagine your chapter next. What's going to be the next chapter in the first few years of the new millennium?
Oh, it's difficult to say. You spoke about the first year, 1900, and it's not only about the Kaiser. It was the first coalition of Germans, British troops, Russian troops against China.
But tell me about the boxers.
And the end of this century, we still have this kind of coalitions against somebody. In this time, in 1900, it was an economic question. The British didn't want to be controlled by the Chinese, by the opium business. And this was the reason for the first war of united troops, all of Europe and Russia and Japan against the Chinese. And if you look to the end of the century, we are using the same matter, and I think in the next century it will go on like this.
But you say, die Zukunft ist zu verplant. In other words, the future is already being too planned away. You're surrounded here by scientists. What's your warning to them?
When the Second World War was over, I was 17 years old. I was surrounded by ruins. Germany was destroyed. But our generation, we had some hope. We thought, perhaps it was an illusion, there will be future. We will do things better and change things. For the young generation today, I think it's much more difficult because it's all it's planned. We know so much what future will be, and there is no possibility, also no possibility to make mistakes. Everything is organized and planned, and I think this is, for the young generation, a great problem.
Just before the scientists have their words, do you feel comfortable about what science is offering you now, like the Genome Project, like Chromosome 22, all these other extraordinary developments? Because you've warned, dynamite, after all, was seen in a positive light, but look what it's done in war.
You see, human beings, we learned in this century in a very quick way what things we are able to do. And they are marvelous inventions, and we say always, yes, we will do it. We are able to do it, we do it. And we never learned to say, yes, we can do it, but we don't do it. We never learned this, perhaps in the atom questions. We never learned to say, no, that's possible, we can do it, but we are not able to control these things, and so we say no. We see that we are living in a democratic world, and I hope this will go on. But we see also that the democratic system is, by its own nature, very slow.
Can you pause it for a moment?
We have inventions all over and things, but they are not...
Okay, just a short pause to explain what's going on here. So this was to be a panel discussion on social responsibility of scientists. Much of it turned then on a certain interpretation of that question, namely, should scientists in the choice of their research, should they keep in mind what the social consequences will be? That's only one aspect of possible social responsibility of science. For example, Einstein's intervention that I described to you was a different kind of aspect. But that's what Günter Grass is saying, that he's upset by the fact that scientists never decide, well, this may be an interesting scientific project, but it may have bad social consequences, so I will not pursue it. That's what he's saying. Scientists have never said no. Okay.
System.
Well, let me ask Professor Günter Blobel, if I may, from Howard Hughes Medical Institute in Rockefeller University in New York. You've done all your work on protein. That's why you're here. Do you ever say, I'm going to stop, this is too risky?
No, I don't share Günter Grass's opinion completely. I share many opinions, but I think there are limitations in the human brain in what we are able to do. And I marvel at what we can do and what we have done, the many wonderful things and many beautiful things humans have done, but we are not perfect. We will always make mistakes.
But do you ever stop yourself when you're looking at a protein or when you're looking at some of your work? Do any of your colleagues, do you think?
No, I think it is an intrinsic urge of humans to know, and that will never be stoppable.
Regardless of the risk.
We have the calm, there are 40,000 people dying in car accidents in the United States alone. So should that mean that we don't use the car anymore? We have electricity, and some people get electrocuted by electricity. Should that mean that we shouldn't have any electricity anymore? I wouldn't like to live in the last century when there was no dentistry to repair my teeth. I enjoy the progress that we make. Yes, there are mishaps and there are mistakes that are made.
Well, Günter Grass was not nodding his head, but I'd like to ask Professor Ahmed Zubail, first of all.
That's apples and pears in one. We know how many people are killed by cars, but there's another thing when Chernobyl or another place is blowing up. You cannot take this together, yes? It's not possible. And if gain manipulation is going on like this without any control, I would like to stop it.
All right, Professor Ahmed Zubail, can I ask you, would you be prepared to stop some of your work? You're a chemist, you've worked on spectroscopy. Do you ever say no to yourself, I can't do that, the risks are too great?
Well, let me just comment on one thing that relates to the previous two comments. I think one thing is missing in this equation, and that is science will continue to progress, and science will continue to be providing new things by individuals. However, the society's responsibility comes here in very important. Even in your own kitchen, you have the knife, and the knife can cut your finger. And so if you don't know how to use the knife properly, you will suffer from this invention. And so there will always be invention by mankind, but it's a question of how to use it, and you need the proper society to teach you how to behave with such technologies and advances.
Now, one of the things, just before I move on to the other laureates, that you and the audience have already indicated to me that you are concerned about is the responsibility of scientists. Would anyone like to come in there, particularly about the issue of accountability? Nicholas, for example, from Sweden.
Okay, I do think that science like solves its own problems. The development of a bomb is mutually followed by the development of something against it.
Now, what's your response to that, Professor?
Well, that's my own feeling also, is that if you look at the cloning problem right now, we really don't know how to handle it, to have the human cloning itself. So it's going away from the laboratory experiment of scientists, but into a societal problem that we have to decide on. And that's why I agree in many ways.
Let's turn to Professor Walter.
Okay, just I'm going to be next in line there. I hope you in this rather confused discussion, which of course panel discussions always are, that you got the idea that the last two speakers, Professor Zubail, Professor Blobel, basically said, no, scientists do not have a special responsibility. Okay.
My view is, I guess, a little different still. I do feel that this is not certainly a purely scientific issue, but I also wouldn't say it is a societal problem. I think it is a problem of scientists themselves participating in this societal problem. Society alone, science is moving so rapidly, as Günter Grass said, society cannot cope with it unless young people, like we have in the audience, or older people, like we have on the stage. You're not old, but you're a little older than me. unless what my wife calls grown-ups, help society in dealing with these problems.
But you already in the University of California, you run two of the big nuclear weapons labs, laboratories, Lawrence Livermore and Los Alamos. You are going through this crisis almost, aren't you? Should scientists be running a nuclear weapons laboratory?
Absolutely, and I've been very much involved in this crisis for the last roughly 12 years. And my answer is crystal clear. It is totally inappropriate, in my view, for a university to be managing laboratories that have developed historically all the new so-called advances in nuclear weaponry and that are still deeply involved in the same business.
What are the scientists saying to you when you sit in that committee and you raise those questions?
You mean the scientists that work in the laboratory? I should make clear for the viewers and also for the young people here that I am not a member of the laboratories. I'm a professor in one of the campuses. I can say perhaps the lead in trying to get the university out of the business of making nuclear weapons. The university has very important tasks to do, much more important tasks that are positive and should not be involved. What do the scientists in the laboratory say? The scientists in the laboratory have, to my mind, a very narrow view, so a view of saying, if the government tells us to do something, we do it, and therefore we are patriots. And I think as we approach, or perhaps already are, in the 21st century, we need to take a broader point of view.
Professor.
So, you have not yet heard Mr. Mandel. If you'd like to hear him, we can run this a few more minutes, or I can summarize for you what he says. Mr. Mandel says, don't worry about any of this, the market will take care of it. Okay. Okay. Well, maybe this is a time for me to stop, and I would be very glad to hear comments and try to answer questions.
Would you like to pick out the people who are sorry?
I don't know them. You do it. Yes. 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 I'll reverse the order of the questions if you don't mind. The second question was, I was asked for further clarification of two expressions. One is the design of new drugs. And what I was referring to there is the following, that the development of new drugs traditionally is carried out in a chemical laboratory. In more recent years, the power of new theoretical methodologies has allowed drug manufacturers, instead of doing experiments in the laboratories, to do calculations using new theoretical concepts and new using fast electronic computers, thereby obviating or eliminating the necessity to do laboratory experiments, and in fact replace them in part, of course, only by theoretical calculations that are often 10 or 100 times faster. So that's what I meant by that. The other expression, I don't know exactly how you quoted it.
Explaining
consciousness. What do I mean by explaining consciousness? Well, what I explained is that I don't know what I mean by explaining consciousness. That this is, unlike many brilliant scientists who say, never mind consciousness, it has been explained, and I tried to express my view that I don't even know what it means to explain consciousness. I think I've answered those questions.
All right, sir.
Well,
can the audience hear?
No.
No, perhaps if you could come to the microphone. You can hear the speaker?
I will repeat the question.
Yes,
I have a microphone here. Okay. So the question, as best as I could understand it, was that the questioner remarked that in this institute some 20 years ago, he heard somebody say that elements which today are known to be distinct, like magnesium and aluminum, at some earlier period, in fact, were the same. If he said that, I disagree with him. So that's my response. Okay.
All right, sir, behind the bar.
Okay, I'll quickly repeat that. Should, in my opinion, scientists as students take courses on ethics or similar humanistic subjects to prepare them for their responsibility towards society? My short answer, and I'll make it short, is yes. I have encountered, for example, in the nuclear weapons laboratories, many scientists who clearly have never had such an education, who are carried away by the purely technological excitement of their work, and they literally behave like star warriors. They love these concepts, and the problems of what's the impact on human beings are often totally ignored. I'll be very specific. I visited, 15 years ago, I visited the museum that exists in the Los Alamos Nuclear Laboratory. It's a museum related to the development of atomic bombs. That was the site of the primary site of the Manhattan Project. And I walked around there, and there were all these technical accomplishments were being explained for the benefit of children. And the only thing that referred to the effect of an atomic bomb being dropped somewhere were two tiny pictures about this size. And they showed Hiroshima and Nagasaki as viewed by the from the planes that dropped the bombs. The point of impact was shown as a white dot, and around it was a circle that was described the area of total destruction. It's taken from a very high level, so the whole thing appeared like, particularly to a child, like a bullseye. And you could see, you could just barely see that there were, that, so to speak, the texture was different within that circle than outside of the circle because of the explosion. There was absolutely no hint of what an atomic bomb does to the victims. The victims didn't play in this at all. It was simply a representation of atomic bombs as a wonderful technical accomplishment. I spoke to the director of the museum afterwards, and he referred me to other people, and that's another story. But in any case, there's an example of people who are not even aware that that particularly for children, they should not only become acquainted with the wonderful technical achievements that led to the atomic bomb, but also with the terrible human suffering that was caused by it.
We have time.